The following Bible study is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
Anyway, I want to begin the book of Daniel, which I think you'll find a fascinating book. Jeroboam was the personal servant of King Solomon. And when King Solomon died, God promised Jeroboam that he was going to give the kingdom to him. He was going to rend, as he says, the 10 tribes away from Israel and give them to this one-time servant, the valet, if you will, of King Solomon. So he went ahead and took those 10 tribes that were up north and split off from Judah to the south, who had the temple. Now what happened was, you understand that the people who had the temple, you know, would always have the Israelites coming down to worship on the holy days. And so they then could have considerable influence on the people who were Jeroboam. So Jeroboam had the idea, I'll just make another place to worship. So he set up a place to worship in Bethel and another place in Dan. And then he built these two golden calves up there and changed the holy days to keep his people from going down and being associated with the other two tribes down there. It caused a massive apostasy through all of Israel. And finally, in 725 BC, these 10 northern tribes of Israel were so corrupt, God had Assyria take them captive. And then they were dispersed all through Persia. And then the Persian peoples were taken and brought down and placed in those northern tribes of Israel. And they became the people called the Samaritans that were so hated by the Jews. And that's why they were so hated, because they called themselves Israel when it was to their advantage, and they never were Israel. They were the Samaritans and Persian peoples brought down. Second Chronicles, if you will, Second Chronicles 36. Judah held on for almost about another 100 years, being faithful to God. But then they too went into a very similar apostasy, and then God sent prophets to warn them of their sin. Second Chronicles 36 and verse 16 is an example here. Here's what happened when God sent the prophets. They mocked the messengers of God, and they despised his words and misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people, until there was no remedy. There was no way these guys were going to repent. They wouldn't do it. And so in about 605 then, God took Judah captive as well. Verse 17 and 18, therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldees, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion upon the young men or maiden, old man or him that stooped for age. He gave them all into his hand, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. Now, to the world, you have to understand the perspective now. To the world, the God of the Jews was now discredited. The ethical, the moral, monotheistic God of the Hebrews had absolutely failed. He appeared to be no match for the God of the Assyrians. He appeared to be no match for the God of Babylon. Israel and Judah had been completely destroyed, their land completely razed. I mean, a fire had come across the cities, and the cities were destroyed, the people killed, and any survivors were removed from the land. The temple of God had been leveled down to ground level, and then whatever remnants of that temple that were left had been completely burned, and the great Babylonian army had shown the world that their gods were superior to the God of Israel. Can you see this, how it would look from the outside world, with Israel now gone and Judah now destroyed? And so it was, if you can see this context, necessary for God to show his people, and all the people of the world, really, his power. His people had failed, but he hadn't failed. The people went into captivity. Why? Because of God's integrity. He couldn't allow such apostasy to continue and not punish those people. God never changes. And so during this time of disgrace and humiliation on these people, God was triumphant. And he would then show the entire world his power, He would show all that he's God, that he rules in the kingdoms of men, and his dominion is an everlasting dominion. God would show this through miracles that he would perform right in Babylon. And to this end, he would place his servant inside the palace, and he would have his servant be among those captives who went into Babylon. And there were a number of the nobles who went in, various statesmen, princes, and aristocrats. And of these were Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, and there was one other man, and that man was the man Daniel. He was born about 620 to a family of Judean nobility. Today we think of him as a prophet, but you in the context of Daniel, I think you'd see that he was more of a statesman in a foreign court, really. But Daniel and these others were the first to be selected when Nebuchadnezzar took over Jerusalem and destroyed it. He took these first, and that indicates that they were the highest of social status and standing. They were, as it were, the cream of the crop of this state, Judah. He took the best there was. Now, Josephus, of course, wrote extensively of this history, and he writes this. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took some of the most noble of the Jews that were children, and the kinsmen of Zedekiah, their king, such as were remarkable for their beauty of their bodies and comeliness of their countenance. And he delivered them into the hands of tutors for their improvement that would be made by them. And so this young Jewish noble wrote the book of Daniel. But he didn't write it when he was a young boy. He wrote this book later when he was actually in his 90s. It's one of the shortest books of the major prophets, but you know, it's probably one of the most important ones, though. It is the one that is the most often studied, and its stories are filled with incredible excitement. They really are. And its prophecies are probably the most often quoted in the Bible. And you can't understand the book of Revelation without first having understood the prophecies of Daniel. You'll see they fit hand in glove like this, and they just make everything clear when you put the two together. One without the other, you just can't understand it. One of the things I think about the book of Daniel that is probably the most wonderful, though, is the stories of faithfulness under extreme hardship, and we'll get to these one after another all through the book. Now, for centuries, the book of Daniel was doubted to be accurate. Scholars that it was doubted that it was written by Daniel. They doubted its accuracy as well. And the view was this, that Daniel didn't write this book at the time he said he did, that is, in the 600s or even in the 500s later on, which is when he actually wrote it. But he's telling the story of what took place in the 600s as we move through an entire lifetime of almost 90 years. But they believed instead that it was written much later as one of the apocryphal books. You've probably heard of those. There's other books that are written that claim to be sort of pseudo-spiritual. They are not included as canon. And some thought that this book, Daniel, was that kind of book. Now, the reason for this, I think, is obvious. Daniel is filled with such incredibly accurate prophecies. And he details this king that would come, Alexander the Great. And he details another king that would come, Antiochus Epiphanes. And he does it with such incredible accuracy that you understand, people, if you see this as being written before it ever happened, this means it is God's book. This means you have to heed what it says. And men don't want to do that. So they want to find a means to say it's not accurate or something like that. So what they've done is they've made claims that it was written much, much later in the Hellenistic period. And they'll use examples of, well, we find Greek words within the book. They'll use those kinds of things. And they'll even claim the accuracy is just too great. You couldn't have this kind of accuracy unless it was written as history. In other words, they say, look, all these things happened, and then he wrote it later. But this, I don't believe, is correct. That I believe Daniel is authentic. And I think it's obvious, really, if you aren't prejudiced against it. You can believe its date and believe its message. Number one, let's go to Daniel 9. Number one, Daniel claims that he wrote it. Over and over again, you're going to see this inside here. And he continually says, I, Daniel, as he writes the book. And here's just one example, Daniel 9 and verse 2. Daniel 9 and verse 2, In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of years whereof the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah the prophet that he would accomplish 70 years in the destruction of Jerusalem. And so you see Daniel writing this. Later you see in the end of the book where God says to Daniel, seal the book, Daniel. In other words, finish it now. This is it. It's done. We're not going to tell them anymore. They'll find out what this means later. It was written by God through Daniel, and he was the author of it. Let's go to Matthew 24 for a minute, too, because this, I think, is probably the most powerful and important truth regarding the authorship of this book. Matthew 24, and in verse 15, where Christ himself says this, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place, whosoever reads, let him understand, then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now here is Christ himself using the name of the prophet Daniel, one. But number two, you understand, he's telling people, when you see what he says, you do this. You put your life on the line. Christ believed totally that Daniel had written this book. And of course, you understand who would have been the one that would have been inspiring him. Yes, it would have been Christ. And so the other thing is this, and I tried to get this, and I'm sorry I didn't have time today, but evidently I've lost a book in the move of the Maccabees. The Maccabees is one of those apocryphal books that is a very legitimate history. And I will get this, and I'll type it up for you so that you'll have this quote, because the Maccabees is a history of the Hellenistic period between the Testaments, between the Old Testament and New Testament, and these people that lived and existed then. Fascinating story of the people who actually were able to overcome the great general Antiochus Epiphanes themselves, a family, actually. They just were named the Hammer, the Maccabees is what it means. They just hammered and hammered and hammered at these people until they overcame them. Anyway, they claim in 1 Maccabees 2:59 through 60 that in fact Daniel was the author. Okay, look at Ezekiel 2. Ezekiel also. Ezekiel 14, though. Ezekiel 14. Because there were contemporaries that worked and lived in the same time, who knew one another. And in the case of Ezekiel, Ezekiel was contemporary with Jeremiah and contemporary with Daniel. All these three men worked at the same time, and they each had a different commission. But look at what Ezekiel says in Ezekiel 14, verse 14. He's saying this, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, that is, in a wicked city, they would deliver only their own souls by their righteousness, says the Lord God. And so God is using Ezekiel, and Ezekiel is now validating that Daniel indeed lived at that time and was so righteous a man, he was equaled in his mind to Noah and the righteous Job. Okay, I want to go over to Daniel 3 just for a minute, and we'll get past some of this. Remember I said that some people have objected in the past to the fact that there were Greek words, and so they say, so it has to have been during the Greek Empire that came far later than Babylon that Daniel was written. But you know what? There's only three Greek words in the whole book, number one, and guess what? Those words are only in chapter 3. They're not spread out throughout the whole book. And then also, these words, Greek words, are the words for musical instruments. And let's think about this for a minute as we read Daniel 3 and verse 5. And you're familiar with this verse. And at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, the harp, the sackbut, the psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. What he's talking about here is the sackbut, the psaltery, and dulcimer. Those are Greek words that we find written here. But I want us to understand that during the 600s, the Greek Empire was flourishing. They had a very strong culture. And you know from history that they were a cultured people, and they were into music, and they designed musical instruments. And some of these instruments were found even up in the 600s, up in Assyria. And of course they would find their way into the court of the most powerful nation in the world. You see, it has nothing to do with meaning that this book was written at a later date. Because if it was written at a later date, what would you see? You'd see sprinklings all through the Bible. You wouldn't just see these musical instruments here. So anyway, another point I want to make out of six and final point is this. The historical facts later have come up to show the accuracy of Daniel. Now what happens is this frequently occurs. There are very liberal scholars that just don't want God to have authority, don't want this book to have authority in their lives. And so they will make various claims to discredit, just as we saw this whole thing about the Exodus being discredited on the front page of the LA Times this last Holy Day season. But they say things that have been later, and this happens repeatedly, later on scholarship has to admit, oh, I guess we were wrong on this, you see. And so the earlier claims are often discredited. But the name given Daniel of Belshazzar has been found in secular records. They said no such person existed. And then they found records that go, oh no, here it is. He did exist after all. And so also they found records now that show that there was a dual rulership in Babylon. You remember what happened in the case of Egypt when Joseph was there? Remember that he was made number two in command. There was a dual rulership for a certain period of time. Same thing happens here, and we'll see why. Because remember, what happened was Nebuchadnezzar was out in the field like an animal. Who do you think ran that great, powerful nation Babylon? Daniel ran it. And so he was a co-ruler there for a long time in there. And so they found records now proving that there was a dual rulership with Belshazzar. Disbelief in the name Darius the Mede was dispelled when secular reference was discovered of him. And then the whole thought here of the word Chaldee was never found in any historical records. And so they said, well, they just made this up. It was just like a fairy tale. And then they found that, no, there were references to Chaldee later on. And so Josephus then also explained this, that he, in his history, wrote that no books were accepted into the canon after the 5th century. So that means this, that that it had to have been written before that. It had to be written before the 2nd, the Hellenistic period, the 3rd century, 4th century, and 5th century B.C. Remember, it's going backwards now in those time periods. And so Josephus said there were no books accepted into the canon before the 5th century. So the 6th century is when it was written. And just remember, as we, about a 90-year-old man writing after having been born about 620 then, about in the 500s. So this was the last book then to receive canonization. But it was accurate, and it is true. And again, the prophecies are just so accurate in this thing. Alexander the Great came into Jerusalem. When he did so, the high priest met him, came out to meet him. And Alexander gave great respect and high esteem to the high priest in Jerusalem when he had came out to take over the land and everything. And he was asked why it was that he gave so much credibility to this high priest in Jerusalem. And he said the reason was that he saw this priest coming to him in a dream, telling him that he would be the one who would conquer the Persian Empire. And he said, then when I came to Jerusalem, I saw the exact same priest coming with that special unique garb, and that's why it was. Josephus recorded this event, and I think it's worth mentioning. When Alexander went up into the temple, Alexander the Great offered sacrifice to God according to the high priest's direction, and magnificently treated both the high priest and the rest of the priests. And when the book of Daniel was showed him, wherein Daniel declared that one of the Greeks should destroy the Persians, he supposed that himself was the person intended. And as he was then glad, he dismissed the multitude for the present. And so instead of coming in and just destroying Judea, God had preserved them by giving a dream to Alexander. But what the point I make today is that when Alexander talked to the priest showed him in Daniel the prophecies about him, and we'll read about the prophecies of Alexander the Great later on. And Alexander believed it was him, and therefore he didn't hurt these people, but did go on to take Persia as it was prophesied he would do. So anyway, the point is this. These prophecies were written far before Alexander the Great and far before the Greek Empire ever existed. In fact, they go beyond the Greek Empire to the Roman Empire, and then you'll see detailed prophecies that go right on down to the point where Jesus Christ returns and the kingdom is going to be set up. I want to notice also this handout here. This is a handout from when I was in class at Ambassador College. And all it does is give you an idea of what events were happening at this time. But what I do want you to see is down here, it says Jeremiah 6:25 to 5:85, Daniel 6:04 BC, and Ezekiel 5:92 to 5:72. And I want us to, at least before we go into Daniel, I want us to at least understand this, that God was not doing just one single work, that he had three separate commissions going. And he had three separate men, servants of God, who were doing this. So let's go over to Jeremiah 1, if you will. That Jeremiah was God's prophet to the people in Josiah's time. And you see there a reference to where Josiah was. And Josiah had instituted various reforms. But then they took his son, made him king after Josiah was killed. And he became one of the worst kings in all of Israel. So God sent Jeremiah as a first commission to first prophesy against these people and warn them and say, you've got to repent. And so we see this here as part of his job. Jeremiah 1, the words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests that were in Anathoth, to the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of the Lord came in the days of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign, came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the 5th month. And so anyway, you see my point is Jeremiah was during this same point of time when these various kings ruled up right until the carrying away of the people into captivity. And so he warned the people of what was going to happen. And he warned the people of God's overall plan. If you go to Jeremiah 25, and he warned them before this captivity took place. Jeremiah 25, 8 through 13. Where it says this, therefore thus says the Lord of hosts, because you've not heard my words, behold, I'll send and take all the families of the north, says the Lord, and Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, my servant, and I'll bring them against this land, and against the inhabitants thereof, and against all these nations round about, and I'll utterly destroy them, and make them an astonishment, and a hissing, and a perpetual desolations. Moreover, I'll take from them the voice of mirth, and the voice of gladness, and the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride, and the sound of the millstones, and the light of the candle, and this whole land shall be a desolation, an astonishment. And these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And it shall come to pass, when 70 years are accomplished, that I'll punish the king of Babylon and that nation, says the Lord, for their iniquity in the land of the Chaldeans, and I'll make it a perpetual desolations, and bring upon that land all my words which I pronounced against it, even all that's written in this book, which Jeremiah has prophesied against all the nations. And so you see, here is again Jeremiah's job of prophesying that here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this land a desolation, and then eventually it'll be 70 years, you'll be in captivity, then I'm going to punish that those people of Babylon. Okay, Jeremiah 43 then. Once Babylon came and took the people and destroyed the land as God had prophesied, Jeremiah's job changed, because then he became commissioned to be responsible, if you will, for the very destiny of Israel. In chapter 43, verse 5 and 6, we'll read this and I'll make some comments. 43, verse 5 and 6. But Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces took all the remnant of Judah that were returned from all nations, where they had been driven to dwell in the land of Judah, even men and women, and children, and the king's daughters, and every person that Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had left with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shephan, and Jeremiah the prophet, and Baruch the son of Neriah. Baruch, of course, was the secretary that worked for Jeremiah, and he did the recording and the writing of these books and so on. But you understand my point in reading this was that Jeremiah then went with these people, the king's daughters, and he took one of the king's daughters. He took all of them, actually, but one of them in particular that became the one who had the child that continued the throne. God had promised that David's throne would never cease to exist until Shiloh come, that is, until Jesus Christ comes, and Christ will come and take over that throne. So here he was now destroying the nation that had that throne that he had promised would exist forever. So now Jeremiah then took the king's daughters up through Ireland and into England, and that's why that stone that's underneath the throne today is that same rock that followed them. That is, they brought that same stone that was the pillow stone of, who was it, Jacob. They brought that with them, took the king's daughters, and went all the way up into England. And so then that king, that throne, is now preserved in England for Christ to return to and take over. So anyway, what happens then is biblically, Jeremiah fades from the scene. But what we find is there are records and traditions in both Ireland and in England that talk about this man Jeremiah and bringing these king's daughters through. Okay, Ezekiel was also contemporary with Daniel, and he was a prophet then to the people who were captives. Let's go to Ezekiel for a moment, Ezekiel 1. So we had Jeremiah, who prophesied to Judah before their fall, tried to get them to repent, but they would not listen to him. And then he also had a commission of taking the king's daughters and reestablishing the throne. Ezekiel was then a man commissioned to work with those people taken captive. Ezekiel 1 and 1 through 3. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, that I was among the captives by the river Kebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly unto Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Kebar, and the hand of the Lord was there upon him. So here he was with the captives. Remember that song that everybody makes fun of me because I think it's so sad? By the waters of Babylon, there we wept, and there we sat down. This is taken from this, where he was sitting down there resting as they were being moved up as captive people into Babylon. And so he oversaw the captives there, and he gives them a message of the terrible destruction to come, and then a message of the incredible hope of a future glory. Ezekiel 2, he also was given a message that was to go to Israel. Ezekiel 2 and verse 3. And he said unto me, Son of man, I send you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. And they and their fathers have transgressed against me even to this very day. So what happens here is that God had given him a message to be given to Israel. But Israel had been taken captive a whole 100 years before this and were pretty much already beginning to be lost. But Ezekiel didn't give them, didn't go to them, and didn't give them the message, but he wrote it instead, a message for Israel that was modern day Israel. And that's why this book is a fascinating book to read, because it talks about what was going to happen in our cities. It talks about the prophecies that are going to lead up until the time when Christ returns. Here's where the scriptures where we find the David being resurrected and being made king over Israel again, and Judah and Israel being brought back together again. Here's where we see all Israel. Remember the resurrection, Ezekiel 37. And we see the temple and the life afterwards in the kingdom. And it's a beautiful, beautiful ending. And so he's giving these people who are captive hope of one day being united once again. But my point is this. I just want to show that there were men working contemporary here. There was Jeremiah, who was going to then prophesy what was going to happen. And once it did happen, he took the king's daughters and established the throne in England. There was then Ezekiel, who went with the captives. Then there was another man, Daniel, who was in the very throne, in the very temple, in the very palace, as it were, with the king, King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Daniel's name is, I think, interesting, and it is this. It means God is judge. And this is the theme of this book, and we'll see that over and over again. God is the judge among all the nations of the world. God called Israel to be his people, and then he sent them into captivity. Then the Jews went into apostasy, kept the faith for a while, then went into apostasy, and that they had the temple, they had the priesthood, they had the true God, they had the law of God. But they were not subject to that law. You understand, the Jews had developed this attitude. They would determine for themselves how they would worship God. They would not let God be their judge. They would not let him be the authority over their lives. And the message of Daniel is this: God is the judge. Now, I want us to understand this tonight in the context of the overall plan of God. God's people who lived at the end of the age are called what? The Church of Laodicea. When you take this word Laodicea apart, it means two things: laos, meaning people, and dicea. Can you hear a word in there? Like decision. It is the people who judge, the people who make their own decisions how they're going to worship God. This thing's playing out all over again. And so the name Laodicea has two possible interpretations, and that is this: the people who judge for themselves, or and the people who are fit for judgment, the judgment of God. The last era is comprised of a people who know the truth of God. They understand it. They were given the truth. They understand the doctrines and teachings. But they have chosen for themselves how to apply those things. They're not going to let God's word rule over them. They're not going to patiently keep God's word, you see. But they'll decide how they're going to worship God. They'll decide how the Sabbath should be kept. They'll decide how they should keep God's commandments. And you see today a watering down among the churches of God and a willingness to sort of twist things so that you can justify your own kinds of behavior. My point today is this: what does God call the great empire at the end of the age? Babylon, doesn't he? It is the same empire that he started with and where he taught this lesson: I'm the judge. And it's the same empire at the end that God's people will be taken captive by again, because they haven't realized he's the judge. And that's why it's so valuable, I think, for us to study this book of Daniel, to understand it in its deep spiritual meaning. If we will let God be our judge now, we won't have to go into captivity, or we will at least be protected if we have to, as Daniel was. So at this point we see God is going to get involved with the nations. And so about 609, Babylon had become the most powerful nation on the earth. They had conquered Assyria. Assyria was a brutal people. They are the Germanic peoples. And when you go back in history, you see the same kind of symbols and swastika and everything with these people. You remember the winged sort of creature there? It's the same thing that they had in their nation. And so they were a people who, when they took captives, they just crushed them. They were brutal. And they would just make examples of people with torture and brutality and so on. Babylon was different. This is called by some historians a pivotal point in history, because now it seems that the world changed from going one direction, which was brutal, to a kinder, gentler. You could say it this way: as brutal as you might find these people of Babylon, they had a heart compared to the other nations that came before them. So anyway, 4 years later, Babylon had taken Jerusalem captive and Judah captive. Let's go to Daniel 1 and begin the book of Daniel there. And verse 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem, and he besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And so in the first year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he attacked Jerusalem and conquered the city. And he took the best of the nation's wealth. He took the richest and the finest of the temple vessels, and he dedicated them to his God, which was Baal. And he didn't take everything. He left some things. That is, he left enough for Jerusalem to carry on its normal business. He left enough of the temple furniture and so on, so that they could carry on a service. And so it looks like he then left Jehoiakim back there to be a vassal for him, that they would send tribute. So he didn't want to destroy the nation. He just wanted to break its spirit, break its will a little bit, take its finest things, and leave enough so that they could be a vassal state and pay tribute to him. So what happened was, is that Jehoiakim then, he rebelled after about 3 years, and Nebuchadnezzar was busy with other wars in the kingdom, and so he couldn't do anything about it. But afterwards, 3 following years, about 6 years total, Nebuchadnezzar then came back, and he took everything then, all the rest of the temple vessels for himself, took all of these things to Shinar. And that was a place you've read about probably when you read about ancient Babylon in the book of Genesis. You read it repeatedly. No one knows exactly where it is now, but Shinar was where they had the most beautiful temple dedicated to Bel, their god. And there they would take from all the different palaces and temples of the provinces and other nations that they conquered, they would take their vessels and bring them to this incredible treasury house and store them there as a tribute to their god. But you understand what God was doing. He was putting his things in safekeeping. 70 years later, they'd take them right back out again. And so those things were returned again when Cyrus let the people go. It took about 19 years for Judah to be completely destroyed. And 3 separate times the king came against Judah, eventually completely destroying it. The first time he came through, however, he took the best of the vessels. He took the best of the furniture, the best of everything, and he took the best of the people, the cream of the crop, Daniel 1, 3 and 4. And the king spoke unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and the king's seed and of the princes, children of whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning and in knowledge and understanding of science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. So Ashpenaz was to bring the various special children, and these were probably kids 12 to about 16 years old, generally. I want us to think just for a minute why they would do this. They would take the best of the children. You understand, they would not take the adults in all likelihood. And our military does this today. You understand, they take new recruits in when they're 18 years old, don't they? Because when you're 18 years old, you're still malleable. You can still be bent. You can still kind of have some resiliency here. But when you're older, like you can imagine if they took me in, I'd just be resisting and, you know, unhappy with everything all the time because I'm just older and I'm just stuck in my ways more. But you can mold the young men and bend them to your ways. And so something I also want to bring up here that some may contest, but I'll give it to you for whatever it's worth here. And that is, it says the master of the eunuchs here was the one who was over Daniel and these other men. And the word here, the term is Ceres, and it comes from the word to castrate. Now, it also means the valet or the servant of the female apartments. And this was likely the chief eunuch here. And all of these young boys were brought into the authority and under the authority of the care of this chief eunuch. And I say this for a reason. You know, if you took the best men, the kids, the best men from any nation that was conquered, wouldn't they have a buried hostility towards the ones who had conquered them? I think they would. And being the most brilliant and the best of the crop there, they also could then do what? Plan insurrection, couldn't they? You can see this. They would vie for power, be power struggles, bringing men who were the best and the most brilliant from the conquered nations into your palace could be a dangerous thing. So it's my suggestion that it's possible these boys who were brought in, the men, young men, were perhaps tempered some way. That is, they could have been castrated because they were under the chief of the eunuchs. And it's very possible then that they were also eunuchs themselves. In other words, it would take some fight out of them. In this case, you never see Daniel marrying, do you? But we did see Joseph. He had a very similar position in Egypt, and he married and had children. But we don't see that anywhere in the book of Daniel. And we see him finally, when the time of the 70 years are over, he's now prophesying to the new rulers what's going to happen here. He's telling them the handwriting on the wall, it's over for you guys, and the new guys are coming in. And he lived until that time, and we'll see that later. And we never see him marrying. So for whatever it's worth, I speculate. Others will say, yeah, just because this guy was was, it says eunuch, it doesn't have to mean that he was a eunuch, that it could just be an officer. And I'm thinking, boy, we're going to read this over and over. These guys were under the chief of the eunuchs. Generally, the people under the eunuchs were eunuchs. And so I would suggest to you that it's a very strong possibility. And one of the reasons why you don't see, for instance, in the New Testament, you see, well, you know, there are little power struggles between some of the ministers. And you see this going on a little bit. And, well, I'm of Apollos and I'm of Paul and so on. And sometimes Paul says, well, I went to these guys, but they weren't nothing to me. And you see that. But you don't see anything from Ezekiel saying, how come I'm out here with the captives and he's in the palace where all the goodies are and the wealth and the splendor and the luxury? He's not complaining, is he? Well, anyway, I'm just suggesting that one of the reasons is because it may be that he wouldn't want to change places with him having been castrated. It's my view. It's not everybody's view. But these young men were from the aristocracy of Judah, and they were ones who were from the king and from princes, and they were the higher educated in the land. They were the hand-picked for their beauty and their brain. And they were people who were able to stand in the court. That is, they had a dignity. They had a bearing about themselves that was noble. And they were then taught the language of the Chaldees and the sciences that they had. And they were generally far advanced. And it would have been an intensive training program. In verse 5 and 6. And the king then appointed them, these young men, including Daniel, a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so these were the individuals that were gifted students. And it would be like today if you were to go to the various colleges and say, well, who's the best you have here? And they would collect the cream of the crop. And that's what they brought them here. And they were going to give them the best of the food, best of the beverages, and they were going to give them a special, intense education for about 3 years. It would be the equivalent of a college education. You understand, we have a four-year college system, and we have summers. But if you pull out the summers, it would be about a 3 years educational system. And I remember Mr. Armstrong said this. He said, even if students came with full-blown degrees and they came to Ambassador College, he says, we won't accept them unless they commit to 3 years. That's the length of time that is necessary for an intense training. How long was the training of the apostles under Jesus Christ? About 3.5 years. So you can see that this is a good figure to really change a mind, to mold it, to give you a good solid education. So they would have studied with probably an intense competition there, because you'd have to score high enough to be accepted to be in the court. And those that were able to score high enough would be in the presence of the king and be his advisors and so on. Others who didn't score that high would probably have lesser positions. So it was very competitive in this. So anyway, the chief eunuch then gave these boys different names. Verse 7, it says, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belshazzar, and to Hananiah Shadrach, and to Mishael Meshach, and Azariah Abednego. And I think giving them these names was done for a specific reason. They had names that were related to the true God. And so it really reflects dominion. It reflects authority. In other words, they're saying by giving new names, what you were no longer exists. You now will become who we tell you you are. And so they gave them new identities tied to Babylon. And they represented then the names of the Babylonian deities, and they were no longer called by the name of their own God. And it was an attempt to pry them away from their past and help them, I suppose, make the transition to Babylon, make them feel better, more like that's where they fit, and so on. Daniel's name was changed. It was, of course, God is my judge. And it was changed to Belshazzar, which meant Baal's prince. That is, their chief god was Baal. And he was being called the Prince of Baal, the Keeper of the Secrets of Baal. Hananiah's name was the Lord had been gracious. This was changed to Shadrach, which meant the inspiration of the sun. And it was, the implication was that the sun would now be the one who gave him his blessings. Mishael meant he who comes from God, and this was changed to he who belongs to the goddess Shishak. She was the goddess of the Babylonians, and it meant that he was to be married to her. as it were, which again would be another indication, if you understand, that it's possible they were actually part of the eunuchs. Azariah meant, the Lord is my helper, and his name was changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nego. And Nego was the morning star, or Venus, and it was the love goddess. Now, these men were given these new names, and they reflected the empire that they were subject to, and they were names of a different god. But these names never affected these men, did they? They never lost sight of who they were and what their identity was. And it's because of this. They carried God's name. They were servants of the true God, no matter where they were, no matter what they were called, no matter what the circumstance. And I remind us today, man, this is a powerful lesson to you and me. Ephesians 3:15, if you will. This is a powerful lesson for us because we live in a modern-day Babylon. We have names that don't apply to what our true identity is. And sometimes we're called various things, aren't we, by other people here. But my point is this, Ephesians 3:15, of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. We are named after God. We have the name Christians. We have within the Spirit of God His name in us. And God is going to give us a new name in the kingdom. And it is our identity. And who He is our hope and our reality. And I ask us to remember this as we study Daniel, that these men were given different names, but never lost sight of who they were, never lost sight of carrying the name of their God inside their mind and their heart. And they lived as those who cared and valued the name of God. And we must live as those people who greatly value the name of God that we carry as well. In verse 8, Daniel decides not to eat the meat that was offered to him. But Daniel proposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now the practice was that the king would be first served and he would eat. And of course it would be a sumptuous meal, way more than he would ever need. And so all the courtiers then would then eat of what was left over from the king's table. Now when it says the king's meat of course always refers to food. When it says the king's meat, it refers really to delicacies. It likely means that he was eating foods, as you can imagine, brought to him from around the world. It would include incredible pastries and exotic foods. Why wouldn't Daniel want to eat of the king's meat? I want to give you some potential possible reasons. One is this. Daniel said he didn't want to defile himself. Well, the Babylonians would, of course, eat unclean animals. And, of course, the chefs would mix, as they do here, too, in our society. They mix unclean animals in their sauces. And they make exotic and delicious sauces, but they're filled with unclean meats in them. And you can't take it out. You can't tell what's what. And so Daniel may have thought, you know, I'm just going to make sure I never have any of this, and so I'm not going to eat the king's meat. But also, there's a second reason. Even if you could tell what was clean and not clean, those people didn't bleed their animals properly the way God said to do it. You're to bleed the animal and not drink the blood. Well, what they did in those days is they killed the animal and kept the blood inside, and they believed that when you ate the blood of an animal, that you also then gained the strength of the animal, and it made you more powerful. And so these animals were not bled properly, and so Daniel would have said, I can't eat the meat because I'll be eating blood, and that's wrong as well. Now, one other thing I think is important is this, is that the animals here were in all likelihood often offered to Baal. They were offered to their gods. And so he would have been, in all likelihood, he knew he would be eating or even drinking the wine. In many cases, the wine was offered to the point is that they often offered libations as well as their meat offered to idols. And as you remember, this was an injunction that even the Gentiles who lived within Israel could not do this, eating food offered to animals. I want to say one more thing. I really believe this could have played a role as well in their thinking. Please understand, their nation was taken captive. Their cities destroyed. their buildings just razed to the ground, and their temple gone. And their people were in captivity now. They were slaves to another people. How would you feel living in the palace, and you were being offered delicacies and being treated like a king? Would you want to eat these sumptuous foods and be treated so good when your brethren were suffering, going without? It may have been, you understand what I'm saying, that he wasn't going to have the best of the best. He wouldn't eat it if his countrymen were suffering so much. So it's just some ideas that I think have some validity to them. So anyway, I want you to think about this. Daniel and his companions could have suffered greatly by this decision of theirs not to eat the king's meat. They could be expelled from the Royal Academy at the least and never get a chance to be a part of the court there. But they could be also faced with physical harm. Many times, if you went against the king's command, you understand the king had ordered this, you go against the king's command, you could easily lose your head. These patriots of the kingdom of God, these young Jewish men, boys really, faced the same sin that Adam and Eve faced. And Adam and Eve failed, didn't they? They ate food that was forbidden to eat. These boys refused to eat food that they believed was forbidden to eat. They passed the first test that our parents failed. And there's a comparison to make here, if you will. Moses grew up in the Egyptian court, didn't he? He was just like the son of the Pharaoh there. And he ate the delicacies that the kings enjoyed. And he could have stayed there, and he could have enjoyed those delicacies. But let's go over to Hebrews 11, if you will. This is specifically pointed out about the great hero of faith, who is Moses. That he could have had the best of the best, just like these young boys. So in verse 24 and verse 25 of Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, it says this: by faith Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. I think that's beautiful. By faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is invisible. So I think it's a beautiful lesson if you can see it. He had a chance to enjoy the delicacies. He had a chance to enjoy the luxuries. And yet he would reject that and take the harder road so that he would have a tougher life. But he says he had respect unto the reward. We have similar choices to make in our lives. We live in a period of time, we're in a modern-day Babylon, where we have the highest standard of living that has ever existed. Do you understand that you and I live better today in our homes than many of the kings live? They didn't have the beautiful things we have. They didn't have chariots like we have, our cars. They didn't have televisions and entertainment centers. They didn't have nearly as nice of things as many of us have. You understand, it took incredible work to get one curtain, you know, made for them. And they had the best there was, but many times our curtains are much more luxurious today in many ways than a lot of the things they had. And they had things brought in from all around the world to eat. But we do that too. We just go shopping and we have pineapple from, we have coffee from Brazil and we have candies from around the world. So we live in a time where we could be spoiled. And I want to remind us of this. Millions of people in our society are seeking pleasure rather than seeking God. And you and I can get caught up in this. We can be seduced by the pleasures of this world. And it happens, consumed with getting more and more for self, if you will. And we could choose to be a part of this world, or we could choose to pull out of it, to take the less chosen path, as it were, the harder path. And why would we do this? We too must see the reward at the end is better than any palace. It's better than any executive could have, any XO, anybody, any Fortune 500 company president, and all their perks that they get. Oh, what we're getting is so much better. And so we take the harder path, and we have to say no sometimes. These young Jews were at the start of their career, and they had to face the peril of noncompliance, and they chose to place their future and their career in the hands of God. And we must do that today too, to choose to suffer loss in order to be with God's people. And if we do, we'll be like Moses. We'll be like Daniel, and we'll inherit a similar reward. So Daniel makes a request of this guy to be excused from the king's meat. Now here's an important point also, if we'll go back to Daniel, that he had favor with this prince of the eunuchs. In verse 9, now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Now, this is something, haven't you noticed in your Bible reading, this is something all that God's servants seem to do. Don't they seem to get somehow favor with those that are in authority over them? Now, God often gives us this favor. But I want to say, too, I really think that it's often something earned by the Christian. You remember what said of Jesus, that he grew in favor with God and men? And it said of the prophet Samuel, he grew up as a young boy with favor with God and with men. You understand that our attitude towards others, I think, makes such a difference in this. If we're humble, if we're cooperative, if we work for our superiors as though we're working for Christ, if we work trying to make our boss succeed, not show ourselves off, oh, look how much I can do, oh, I'm so much better than everybody else. No, we want to work to make them successful. Well, when we do that, then we endear ourselves to them, don't we? And then they like us. And guess what? They give us favor. And I think this is what happens. And I remember the case of Joseph so well, where he'd find himself in these terrible situations. But he wasn't abrasive. He just humbly tried to serve others, whatever situation he found himself in. And so he got favor with the prison guards. He had favor with Potiphar, even when Potiphar's wife accused him. Potiphar really knew, I think, that it wasn't true. So anyway, it shows in the next verse, and I'm saying this for us for practical wisdom, that we do this in our jobs and do this when we find we have someone in authority over us, that we try to be cooperative, humble, and work for them as though they were very Christ. Back to Daniel, Daniel 1 and verse 10 this time, 10 through 16. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall you make me endanger my head to the king. You see what I mean? It's very dangerous to make a decision like this. But yet these guys were willing to take a stand. And so the eunuch is going, well, this I could lose my head over this. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Ananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove your servants, I beseech you, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenance be looked upon before you and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat. As you see, deal, and then as you see, deal so with your servants. And so he consented to them in this matter and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them pulse. And so the king himself had appointed the diet of these men, and the prince feared to make any change here because he could lose his life by decapitation. And Daniel requests that they can eat pulse. And what pulse was just simply vegetables that were grown by seeds. And that would be seeds of any kind, or grains, barley, wheat, rye, peas, you know, the normal vegetables and so on. Now, a diet of vegetables often, it is said, will clear up skin problems and make your skin look nicer. But this was different, wasn't it? They looked fatter. Nobody eats vegetables and looks fatter. And I say this for this reason. I believe that God intervened directly for these men. He gave them radiant health. And it was because they had rejected the delicacies of the king. They had done this to honor him, and so God intervened for them. And I think there's a tremendous lesson, Matthew 4, tremendous lesson in this brief little encounter in these few verses. These men had learned something that Jesus Christ had taught many years later openly to his followers. And he said in verse 4 of chapter 4, "But he answered and he said, It is written, Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." Sometimes God's people look at the law of God as being a kind of hindrance to us to some degree. We can't always work at the job we might want to work at. People I know have lost jobs because they've said, I'm going to keep the feast. And people have been told, you keep your feast, you don't come back here to work. You're gone. And they've lost jobs. And so sometimes, too, when we work at the profession we've chosen, sometimes we feel we're limited. We have to tell employers, no. We have to do what these men did, you see. We have to say, no, I can't do this or I can't do that. And so I've seen this happen over and over again. People of God have had to say no to employers. And in some cases, they've lost jobs. But you know what? I've never seen this not be this way. They always get better jobs because they lost the job for Christ's sake. And over, I see this. God will bless us for our obedience. He blessed these boys. He made them grow fatter. They looked better. They were healthier. And yet they didn't have the best diet, some would say. I remember when I went to Ambassador College, I told my employer, hey, look, I'll work part-time for you and stuff, and I did that for a couple of years, and I couldn't juggle stuff anymore, so I had to quit, and I quit and went ahead and finished my last year. And when I came back, it was one of the most difficult things we had to do in air conditioning is every month you had to be on standby for a weekend. And so every month I would battle for 25 years to find someone to replace me for the Sabbath. And it was just horrendous struggling to do this and always have someone to cover because, hospitals go down, computer rooms go down. You've got to be able to go there and you've got to be able to call and say, yes, we'll have a man there, bang, and send someone. And so I'd fight this all the time. Well, when I came back, I didn't even ask them. I just said, hey, I'd like to come back to work. You got a place? They said, yeah. And then they said, oh, by the way, standby, we'll eliminate it. We'll just tell the other guys it's a condition of employment. Nobody gets out of it. But I'm just saying, you understand, I was trying sincerely to obey God, taking time out of my job and everything. Going back to it, it even got better. I never had to deal again with this standby issue. My point is God will bless for obedience. When we're really seeking Him, He'll bless us in unique and usual ways if we'll obey Him. And He did bless these boys in more ways than one. Look at verse 17. Verse 17. As for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And so God blessed them in the studies that they undertook. They didn't just learn knowledge. God gave him special wisdom. Remember what he did for Solomon? He wanted, God gave him any blessing you want, and he chose wisdom. And so God gave him wisdom, and then he gave him all kinds of riches as well. But he had supernatural wisdom, and he gave that to these men. And Daniel received a unique blessing, and he was able to understand visions. And it doesn't mean, and dreams, and it doesn't mean, you understand today you have people who say they can interpret your dreams and all of that. That isn't what it means. It just means dreams that were given by God, divine dreams and visions. He could understand those things that would happen in the future, and it was referring only to those things God inspires. But again, I'll bring up the parallel to me of Joseph in Egypt, that he had been given that very same gift as well. He was a captive at first. Then he gained favor with those who were in authority over him. Then he was given the ability to interpret dreams, and then he is elevated to second in command, and finally controlled most of Egypt under that severe famine. And Daniel also then controlled Babylon. Finally, their training was over, and the captains, these captives came before the king Nebuchadnezzar himself in verse 18. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, and the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And when it says end of days, it's talking about the three-year study program. They were now going in for their final exam This was it, an oral final exam. And then he questioned all of them, and the king communed in verse 19 with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. To me, this is an astounding thing, because there were boys from all the provinces and all the nations. And of all of these, there was only four that were going to be allowed to stand in the king's presence, to be his advisors and so on. And it happens to be these four. But again, you see, this has to be the direct intervention of God. They didn't just get a few marks higher. They were just far and away above everybody else. Verse 20, and in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better to all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. Now, I want to mention this about the magicians and astrologers. Some people argue, in all the commentaries, they argue, well, you know, were they, you know, how much of this were they involved with? Were they involved in magic and the occult and astrology and all of that? And the magicians in these times, well, what they did was they used these charts that they superimposed over the stars and so on, and they would divine what would be the best decision to make for governmental leaders. Now, did these men excel in these kinds of occult practices? And I'm telling you, people really argue this. No, they weren't doing anything like this. What does it say? It just said they excelled those who did these. You see, they weren't participating in these things. No, their judgment was so much better. And of course it would be, wouldn't it? Look, they didn't rely on magic and superstition. They relied on the principles of God's law and his truth. And so they would have wisdom and understanding. They had studied the history. They had studied the sciences. They had studied the astronomy and all of that and the language. They had vast knowledge. Then God added wisdom to them, you see, so that they knew how. What is wisdom? It's the right use of knowledge, isn't it? You can have all the knowledge you want in the world, and you can be real nerdy and not be able to make decisions. These fellows had wisdom. They knew what to do with the knowledge, so they could deduce what's right and what's wrong here. What are the flaws you see in this plan that might be presented? Where's the loopholes? What's the wrong thinking that's here? They go right to it. They could see right in the core of it. They could see then contingencies and patterns, and they could help make decisions based on facts and based on truth and based on principles of human nature and God's law. They had discernment and ability and knew how to apply their skills. They could perceive these things that were ill-devised and figure out the best course of action to take. And so they would have what you might think of today would be the best legal judgment. What's the best thing to do under the circumstances? And they could advise the king the best. Well, these other guys are casting bones around and putting their charts up and saying, what do the stars say? Well, you can imagine these men, blessed with the Spirit of God, with wisdom and knowledge and knowing the law of God and the truth of God and studying this way, of course they'd be better than these other guys. But there's a lesson, I think, too, from their experience, if you let me say so. Sometimes our young people go to school and they have to go to the feast. And so there's a week or two sometimes that they don't get the study the other kids get. And so they have to start school and they're behind. There's other times where they're pulled out for holy days and so on. And many times the teachers will be all upset and they'll go, oh no, they'll be behind and they won't be able to do this and they won't be able to do that and they'll never catch up. And invariably what happens? Our kids always do better in school than the other kids. They always do. And there's a reason for this. What is it? If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And who gives to all men liberally. He'll give the help. And our kids are taught the principles of life. And they're taught to read. And they're taught to think. And this is so much more important. And our kids will generally tend to excel because God will bless for obedience. God is wisdom. He is knowledge. And he'll give us wisdom if we'll seek him and give us favor and employers. And so it is that anything that we ask, he says he'll give us. And he did this for Daniel and he did it for the others here in this unique situation. Verse 21. And Daniel continued, even unto the first year of King Cyrus. And so Daniel continued to be a chief advisor to the emperor there in the empire up until the end of the Chaldean Empire. In all likelihood, he was in his 90s when he finally wrote his memoirs that we see recorded in this book, Daniel, now. He was one of the first to be taken captive, and I believe he lived to see the end of that captivity and to see his people finally freed as an old man. Parallel with John as well, isn't it, in Revelation? So that concludes chapter 1 in our introduction to Daniel.